And from that Auckland is Ant Timpson, the head honcho of the Incredibly Strange section of the International Film Festival. Ant Timpson, welcome to Cinematica.
Thank you, Dan. Thanks for having me on this glorious day.
It's a glorious day in Wellington too. You're not alone in that. I've got a quick question for you to start off, Ant, to sort of place you in your cinematic context, if you will. You describe yourself as a film head. So could you tell us what a film head is and why we should aspire to be one?
Wow. I don't think anyone should aspire to it. I think you're either one or you aren't, and it's really a term that I just started using as a way to describe myself when I was doing a fanzine, actually, way back in the late 80s. And it was really just a term for obsessive film people who live and breathe film possibly a little bit too much. And so film head was, it was just a way of signifying that how deep you've gone. You've gone from passing interest, you've gone from film enthusiast, from then film connoisseur, and then sort of film head is, you know, the seventh black belt stage of film viewer and film obsessiveness. So yeah, it's just it was really a silly term. In a kind of way, it was around that time that Andre the Giant has a posse was that. That whole idea of throwing a term out there for so long then hoping that it would actually catch on and become widely used as a signifier out there in the public that people could tag themselves with. Unfortunately, it never really caught on. But I did notice that as much as I continued to keep using it, it has sort of popped up here and there over the last 20 years or so.
Okay, so if a film head is sort of born rather than made, when did you realize that you were one?
Well, I think really early on, and this is going to be kind of embarrassing.
Then all the better.
But I had a propensity to get annoyed with people who spoiled movies for me when I was young, and I guess this is before the term spoiler was so well known. And I remember seeing, when we lived in America, and I think being in America as a kid when we shifted was a huge part of falling in love with films because we were really out there on our own. And I think being near Hollywood and seeing all that side of things got caught up. And I was going to a school that had a lot of celebrity kids, you know, who had famous active parents. So you get kind of wowed by that at an early stage. So I remember going to the movies when I was like 10 or 11 there, and it was a Disney movie. It was Candleshoe with Jodie Foster, and the kid I went with was a neighbor. I didn't really know the kid very well. He's a kid, and I was a kid as well. But he turns around in the first 2 minutes and says, because the whole thing is this build-up of this film is about where the treasure is hidden, and it's like a quest movie. Mm. And he turns around in the first 2 minutes and goes, "Oh, the treasure's hidden in the suit of armor." And I punched him in the face straight away, which I don't think is any sort of behavior that should be congratulated
or encouraged.
Or encouraged or admired. I guess the nth degree of that are those guys in cinemas who tell people to stop talking on their phone and then they shoot them in Kansas or somewhere in the middle of America. So luckily I haven't gone down that path. I mean, I do get very aggressive with people in cinemas who continue to keep making noise after the initial shushes and so forth. So, yeah, I think at that very early stage, that was like a little glimmer into, wow, maybe I take my films kind of seriously, even though there's a lot of joy. There's a very serious dark side, obviously, to it all as well.
This show, Cinematica, is about celebrating going out and watching films with other people, no matter how frustrating they are to us. Do you still believe in cinema as a medium, as opposed to just other ways of watching moving images?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm not a huge fan. I don't think I watch very many films sitting around viewing them on a TV anymore. I mean, primarily, you're going to be watching them in a cinema situation or blown up on a decent-sized screen is really how I watch my movies. I mean, there's just so much material out there that it's one of the rare sort of treats is to watch a film as, I guess ultimately they were intended to be by the filmmakers, but, you know, these days I think people are kind of content to know that their work is just being screened. When you're competing with Dancing Cats on YouTube and everything else, ultimately people are just happy that their film gets some sort of audience, and then secondary to that is where it's going to be screening. It's still funny that, you know, just up until the last couple of years, people were really, like, passionate that as filmmakers they weren't happy unless it was playing on 35mm in a cinema of certain size and substance. It just wasn't like, I can't call myself a filmmaker if I don't have that payoff at the end of the day, whether this is a short film or whatever. And nowadays you're kind of happy that your film's going to be torrented and people are actually going to see it, because it is so hard to get your work in front of an audience these days. So, but as a viewer, I'm all about the big screen. And so I've been rallying people to cinemas ever since I sort of started getting into exhibition side of things. And running an art house, you know, from the glory days of the highs of the Charlie Greys in Auckland right down to when that was, we were struggling on the bones of our ass to get people in the door. I've seen it from both sides, and, you know, it's in your blood. You just either love going to the movies or you don't. Mm. And I think these days with all these annoyances that people have in cinemas, and, you know, there's talk of making, you know, certain texting only sessions, and, you know, now they're talking about 4D, which is smoke and stench coming flying at you as some person shakes your chair or something. I mean, it's really kind of, we're such a short attention span generation now, it's that people cannot just sort of be happy sitting there watching a film. They have to have everything else going on around them. So it's kind of sad in that respect, but, you know, you can always make your own cinema from out of nothing, really.
Yeah, you talk about 4D and people shaking your chair and what have you. That sort of harks back to the early days of exploitation cinema and the sort of the carnies that would sort of travel around America with their films, with all of the showmanship that involves. And I sort of feel like, having worked with you in the past, that you're very much part of that tradition of real showmanship, and you know, a screening isn't just a screening, it's an event. Where did you learn that?
I used to read a lot about film history, and I'm a big avid consumer of all those types of industry novels about certain personalities that paved the way of early forms of exploitation. That's where the term roadshow came from. It's like the style of release patterns that used to happen before plexes took over. And so I love a lot of Americana, and primarily it is all based in American history of film. And I guess I'm so entwined with, you know, the way film was released. But, you know, that is such a microscopic look at what cinema is in terms of, you know, it was happening elsewhere at the same time or even earlier. But for me, it was all about the carny guys, the Kroger Babb type individuals, the Dwayne Espers, of the very sort of heyday of where films were taken from town to town, and they, you know, like preachers, basically set up tents and had a huge carnival aspect to it. And I love the fact of, because we always use that analogy of cinemas being churches, and, you know, people congregating and all listening to the one message that's being sort of conveyed across. And I think that's, you know, directly harks back to those style of early roadshow, where there was a sort of religious fervor to the films, and they used to play up on all those sort of angles as well, you know, whether it was the films that were about promiscuity or the dangers of drugs and the illicit. That was very much the bread and butter of the roadshow circuit.
It's exactly. Like, one way or another, these things were going to change your life.
Yeah, you had to see them. I mean, it was like you were basically going against the word of the community if you didn't sort of sign up and read the little, you know, they used to have little booklets, and before a lot of these films, we used to play them in the early days of the Incredibly Strange, films like Mum and Dad, which, you know, it was, if the books were ever done properly, and they weren't, because the guys who released those films were, like, known as the 40 Thieves, and they were they were basically the biggest bandits in cinema history, where they used to, there was, I mean, phenomenal stories about going into small towns, finding an abandoned cinema that had closed down and just basically smashing the door open, putting out a sign saying open and chucking their films on and pillorying the public for a weekend and then hightailing it out of town. I mean, they were like complete desperados. And there's been no accurate bookkeeping, but the films like Mum and Dad took a lot of money back. The estimates of over 100 million back in the day are just crazy figures. So, yeah, I mean, I love that aspect of it, that there's a bit of a wild recklessness to the whole scene, and that it was a bit like the Wild West. And the whole business is still kind of operates on that very nutty level, that it's all done with handshakes and things, and everyone has to believe the next person that they're dealing with that it's all kosher. There's no sort of direct line of seeing the transparency of where everything is being spent and where everything is going. And so,
even here in New Zealand, distributors still sort of send anonymous representatives to do head counts at screenings.
I mean, I'm sure
they audit on that basis.
I'm sure they do, except there's just, you know, everyone is so overworked and so busy these days. I'm not sure if they're keeping up on that sort of micro level. And I know that there's a lot of decent operators. It's definitely changed from the early days where,
one for me, sort of thing.
I mean, I guess, and you know, there's a great tradition of money being laundered through cinemas. I'm not necessarily saying in New Zealand, but I've definitely heard many, many stories about certain companies that were involved with, you know, basically saying that, you know, there was only five people last night, but there was, you know, there was 500 who came through the door, and it's cash out in the pocket. And so the books all look very depressing, but they're doing extremely well buying houses on coasts all over the place. So, we're suddenly gone totally off topic. But
no, I don't know. We're getting round to it, because I'm going to come back to The Incredibly Strange now. And you talked about going up against the community, you know, it's a sort of rebellious thing going to those sorts of movies. And you went up against the Society for the Protection of Community Standards here in New Zealand back in the day, and you had some very well-publicised battles with them. Are they still a force to be reckoned with?
I don't think they were ever a force to be reckoned with. They were more like an annoying gnat in the room buzzing around. But it's funny you mention that, because I'm literally holding the book A Stand for Decency by Patricia Bartlett and the Society for Promotion of Community Standards, 1970 to 1995, by Carolyn Moynihan. It's a great book, and if anyone's out there, you see it in a secondhand bookshop, I highly recommend it. It's got a lovely photo right now that I'm looking at of John Banks watching Driller Killer in absolute horror, with a photo of Patricia Bartlett next to him, who actually isn't watching the film. She's looking down, because she never actually wanted to watch these things, you know, even though she had the biggest collection of pornography in the country for a while. But yeah, those guys, I think they moved into greener pastures for them and focused on, you know, a lot more, you know, I think they found that the idea of raising a red flag around a film was really had the opposite effect of what they really set out to do,
totally.
Which was to take and to hide it from the audience. But all they did was basically alert the audience and drove customers to view the film, whether it was on DVD or whatever. So they sort of stepped back and started going after the, you know, the prostitution law reform and various other sort of other areas of
other moral questions,
moral turpitude, you know.
Yeah.
So, no, I haven't heard from them. No one's really heard from them. I know that the film festival used to be sort of railroaded by this ridiculous nature of very last-minute sort of borderline injunctions on certain titles, which was an incredibly painful thing to go through when you, as you would know, dealing with print shipments and everything and trying to get schedules locked and having a film held up through a ridiculous loophole, basically, is what it was. Even though they were, you know, sticking to the letter of the law, it was something that needed to be looked at and not exploited by certain parties.
Hmm. Let's talk about Incredibly Strange now. And when was the first Incredibly Strange festival that you put together for New Zealand?
Well, the very first Incredibly Strange Film Festival was 1994 in April. In the Capitol Cinema in Auckland, and that's, I think I was still probably working at the Capitol at that stage as well, and so it was kind of like, might have just left, putting it on in the theatre that I knew very well, or the owners that I knew very well, and it's I'm not even sure I had plans to do Wellington that year, but I think Auckland went so well, it was like, let's make a booking for Paramount in Wellington. And so that happened maybe in June of that same year. So, and then from then on, it sort of expanded rather quickly. And it was just really surprising the amount of attention that it got that very first year. I've still been archiving a lot of footage from previous years, and it was really interesting to see that we sort of made a lot of we got a massive amount of media coverage that very first year.
Well, there was nothing quite like it, was there, before? I think that we had only the international festival at the time, which wasn't branded international. It was the Wellington Festival or the Auckland Festival, and I think that there was audiences in New Zealand had a particular idea about what constituted an art house or festival film, and you broadened that definition almost instantly.
Yeah, I think it was completely opened the sort of presumption of elitist sort of art snobs going along to the film festival, and offered an alternative to that. I mean, the major festival was never like that, but we sort of we had fun saying that it was like that, and that this is the sort of alternative, fun, crazy, populist festival flying in the face of tradition. I seem to remember that there were probably other mini festivals around that time that were very sort of, there might have been a French film festival popping up here.
Right, and the Showcase was around as well, wasn't it, as well?
And I think the Showcase was, obviously Richard Weatherly had a companion film festival to the major one that used to travel around as well. And I think that ended up possibly the Showcase taking over that route.
Yeah, sort of evolved into it.
Yeah, it evolved. I don't know if there was an official handover or whatever, but it certainly picked up the slack of one that hit every other sort of region as well and became a smaller travelling film festival. We only ever went to, I think, 5 locations with Incredibly Strange at its peak. And at that stage, when you're dealing with film, it was a real rigmarole for a very small operation to have a lot of different locations and a lot of films being held up for that length of time in terms of scheduling. So, yeah, it was just a crazy fun period. We all look back on it, everyone who worked on that festival, really fondly. Wonder why. I don't know whether it could ever survive to the extent that it did back then. It was very, very successful for that period, but that it's completely changed. You're talking about a country that literally had no cult cinema available on home video and not playing on television at all. So there was various, there was a little bit that trickled in during the VHS days, which was great, but once everything switched over and the Classification Act came in and it became very tightly regulated in terms of ratings.
And yet this was a country that had a former prime minister that would introduce horror films on a Friday night on television. So there was obviously some potential there for that kind of weirdness.
Yeah, I mean, I think the live aspect of people hanging out as a group and giving them, it was very much, it felt like a lot of the times, like a gig event, like bands going to see bands and things. It was there was a lot of crossover in terms of we brought back late shows a lot. There was, the idea of late cinema had sort of died out, and we had a lot of pack sessions on Friday, Saturday, very late. And I mean, that's where the whole sort of 24-hour film marathon spun out from there as well. And yeah, I just think it was servicing a definite need within the, that 18 to 25 sort of demographic. And surprisingly, a lot of people hung in there and became very loyal to the Incredibly Strange sort of ethos. Mm. And there's some very, very devout fans who have really helped keep the brand of it alive over the years.
I remember in the mid 2000s when I was running the Paramount and we had the Incredibly Strange every year, that when we put tickets on sale, we'd get basically the entire working population of Miramar at the time, everybody from Weta Digital and Weta seemed to sort of take their lunch break off and come and queue to buy their tickets. There were a lot of film fans out there who were really being fed by the Incredibly Strange, and they knew that it was their one chance to get something that they maybe were missing out on that they had used to get at home.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, I mean, if I'm being sort of analytical about it, I definitely feel that there was a lot of really great material that came into the country that opened people's eyes to a lot of material that they, you know, the internet wasn't around, so they weren't, it wasn't easily available for viewing. So it became a very much a one note sort of shop for people to get new experiences. Sorry, I just got a hand-delivered parcel.
That's all right. You carry on. You carry on with your daily business there. You just make yourself at home. what are your highlights from those years? What do you feel like you're most proud of in terms of either the programming or the events?
I mean, there's nothing that really sort of pops out as like a signature film or a moment. I mean, I've just got so many great fond memories of particular screenings, and it's not necessarily the film that was anything special. It was just that moment. I mean, oh God, man. I mean, just seeing things like, you know, just outrageous films playing in glorious cinemas like the Civic in Auckland was just bizarre to me that we were able to do that. And seeing things like we used the St. James as well in Auckland, a film like Psyched by the 4D, which literally maybe a handful of people ever saw on first release. And then on a Tuesday night at 9:30, we're getting 350 people along, all sort of tuned in together, totally going with the vibe and just, you know, feeling this wave of elation of people all grooving on this one insane slice of cinema that would never, ever be playing in any cinema in the world again. It was just, yeah, truly remarkable. And it was something that I don't know if it can be repeated with now that everything is just one click away from downloading to your desktop that you'll never watch anyway, but you just line them up in files of films that you've heard about.
Yeah, I think what a lot of people do is they give them 5 minutes, don't they, and they go, nah.
Yeah, it's a lot different when you've set yourself up, you've bought a ticket, you've gone along, you're sitting in a cinema with a bunch of other people really who are just on your wavelength as well. And then that's, you can never duplicate that experience sitting at home and looking at your AVI files in a folder. I mean, it's it kind of saddens me a lot, and I get really angry about the whole aspect of what I call the digital trough. And I wrote a big essay about it, actually. Which a lot of people made fun of. But it came from a very pure place in my heart that I felt that something had completely died in the last 10 years in terms of the hunt and exploration for film, and now that everything is simply available, I think something has changed, altered dramatically about the way people absorb these films and the fact that it's just too easy to digest, that there is no salivation and expectation.
Anticipation.
Yeah, it's all completely gluttonous, pig-like behavior that is beyond the McDonald's multiplexes of what we used to be terrified about as a single screen. This is just consumption on a level that you can't even comprehend. And I used to see it, and when DVD came out, that there were just stacks of DVDs in people's rooms that they'd unopened in plastic that they just never will ever watch, you know. And I just couldn't comprehend doing that, this whole collector mentality. And then now it's just all files.
Yeah, I'm still a collector. I must admit that I'm old enough to still sort of quite enjoy the silver discs side of things and the tactile ownership of collecting. But that goes back to my record collecting days. And I think it's the idea of just of being able to have anything on tap and then just dismiss it. You know,
it's just too easy. And I think anything that's so easy is not good. There has to be some sort of challenge involved, I think. I don't know if challenge is the right word, but yeah.
Yeah, I want to ask you now about the end of the independent Incredibly Strange, because it had got to be a massive sort of endeavour by the end. I think, weren't we up to 4 weeks or something in its final year?
Yeah, it was a month long. The last year was incredibly ambitious. We had live events we actually even had live events, I think, overlapping in two cinemas in Auckland, which is ridiculous. But yeah, it was a massive year the last year. And then it had already changed its branding to the Bex Incredible Film Festival.
Right.
Incredible Film Fest at that stage. And then 2003 was, yeah, the year that I pulled the plug on the whole thing. And it was a pretty crappy year to go out. I mean, that I look back at that guide and the lineup that we had, and it was a pretty phenomenal lineup of films as entertainment value. And it was cheap, man. We did those 10-trip tickets, which were dirt cheap when you rounded it out. I was really proud of that whole last year and everyone who worked on it.
Already decided to pull the pin before Bill approached you to start programming a strand of the International?
Well, he didn't approach me at all. I'm pretty sure I put it as a proposal to them, and that was a long time after.
Right.
So it wasn't like an offer I couldn't refuse or anything. I think what was driving me nuts about the festival was that I hated the admin side of it.
Yeah.
And I hated all that aspect of it. I loved watching films with people. That was unbeatable. But running a festival, that's just a small part of it. And it's just, you know, we were hiring out venues, four walling, it's called. And so we were basically running these venues completely, doing our own ticketing. Cookie was writing his own ticketing software on an Apple II. In 2003, let me remind you, an Apple II was 1978. So we had lots of problems. We were, you know, stocking toilet paper and toilets. It was right down to that sort of level. So then I thought, it took 6 months to recover from that last festival, it was like, I love the idea of programming films. I just don't like all that other aspect of it. So the throwing it up to the International Festival was like a no-brainer. It was like they were claiming that they claimed that we always were taking away their youth market, or they noticed that we were, that a lot of what The Incredibly Strange was doing was something that could easily fit within their model, because they needed to get younger customers coming along.
And is that also to do with the just the changing nature of festivals internationally, and also the, I guess, a growing sort of maturity in the New Zealand audience?
Yeah, I mean, there's a little bit of that. I mean, there's also the fact that exhibition is getting so incredibly tough for distributors to get titles onto screens now, that festivals become pretty much the theatrical for a lot of these films.
Mm.
And so what you're seeing overseas is something that I always sort of told a lot of people who are struggling as distributors in small and large territories, that instead of trying to buy titles and release them on, you know, self-release small films, which is exhausting work and so expensive to do and very little return, is to combine them into sort of mini festivals and travel around a circuit and split your costs that way, which is a lot easier. And so I suspect that's what's going to continue to happen in Australasia as well, that you'll start seeing more sort of micro fests popping up that are sort of niche branded and that travel to a lot of territories. And every cinema knows that there's going to be a wave of national sort of promotion that they will be from.
Those regional festivals like the Italians, the French, the Latin Americans and the Spanish, they do have their followings, don't they?
Yeah, and if you hang around long enough, you develop a brand that's recognisable and that people and expect it to pop up each year. And that's invaluable. You can't spend money that beats longevity in the entertainment field, you know. So it's it just takes away a lot of pressure to have to relaunch yourself every time. So yeah.
Let's start talking about this year, because this is obviously why we're talking to you now.
Yeah.
And this year's Incredibly Strange. How do you feel it stacks up alongside the ones that you've programmed in previous years?
It feels a little bit skimpy this year in terms of the number of films, and I think that was primarily because we lost a couple of titles at the last minute. I think this might be the smallest one section ever since 2004. I'd have to look back, but to me, I could definitely deal with a couple more titles in there. One of the late ones, Compliance, that I saw early this year that I really wanted. Bill and I both agreed that it was probably more suited to the main section, even though it's sort of one that I was chasing, and that's a great film. by Craig Tobell. If anyone hasn't heard about it, don't read up too much on it. Just go along and be prepared to argue with people after the film about the content of it. But yeah, I'm pretty happy. I think it's a really wide and varied mix inside the Incredibly Strange. And it's kind of cool this year that there's been previous years that have been kind of highly violent and kind of excessive in terms of the visceral nature of them. And I know that there's an audience for that stuff. And I always try to cater a title or so to those guys who are the gore munchers and who love the types of like the Dead Snows and all those sort of films, which, yep. you know, I'm a huge fan of as well. But you sometimes have, if you have a overbalance of those sort of titles, it can really cloud people's perception of the entire section. And I think even calling it Incredibly Strange can sometimes maybe put off an audience that I think should be coming to films like last year, Kill List, you know, might not necessarily be, even though I think it kind of fits the Incredibly Strange brand because it is a very strange hybrid film. Sometimes, you know, I think that audiences might overlook certain films that they should be really checking out.
You talked about the tussle between you and Bill over compliance, and I think that that says how amorphous the relationship is now between the Incredibly Strange and the main part of the festival. I mean, in a few years ago, something like Beasts of the Southern Wild, for example, would have been an Incredibly Strange film, and now here it is opening the main part of the festival. Do you find that those lines are harder and harder to find?
No, not at all. Not for me. I mean, there's no way Beasts of the Southern Wild would be playing in the Incredibly Strange section, even though in terms of if you read a plot description of it, it might feel like it could easily slot in. But that, you know, a film like that that's a, you know, a critical jury favourite from out of Sundance or whatever is probably not going to...
Yeah, I suppose you were never much one for Cannes winners, were you?
No. Oh, well, hold on. We've had a couple, actually, over the years. And this year we've got Sightseers by Ben Wheatley from the director of Kill List. And it has definitely won a lot of favour in Cannes. It was one of the sort of most acclaimed films that came out of Cannes, not necessarily in terms of awards or prizes, but critical faves. But yeah, no, I'm pretty happy. We don't, you know, Bill and I don't really, we don't sort of put on boxing gloves and go hammer and tongs at each other over title. He's been very gracious in films that that I've wanted and that might have actually got bigger audiences within the main fest, but it's hard to know. There's always one of those questions that we ask ourselves every year about would they do better in this or whatever section you're in? A documentary, would it do better in the doc section or will it do better in Incredibly Strange? Mm.
How do you program it? Where do you source your titles for that section? Do you travel to festivals still yourself?
Yeah, I don't travel as much as I used to. I used to travel about 4 months a year to festivals, and then since having a family and everything, it's changed. You know, it's the brakes have been put on dramatically. I still probably get to maybe two a year, I think. But within that, I've got a lot of really good friends who are either festival directors or programmers for a lot of major festivals around the globe, and it's quite easy to keep heads up on certain titles. I mean, everyone wants to find those films that no one else has found. But the reality is they're not going to premiere down here unless they're local films. It's very hard to get dibs from sales agents for premieres down here. So we, you know, it's not rocket science really to find. It's just films that reflect your taste. And it's quite, you know, there's a lot of selfish behavior behind certain title selection as well. there's probably some that I know, Bill will probably hate me for saying that, I know I'm probably going to bomb, but I really just want to play the film. And then so sometimes there's more populist films like Cabin in the Woods, obviously, is going to be a very, you know, successful film. It's one of the fastest selling already. So.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that and actually get your take on the Cabin in the Woods phenomenon and what the heck was going on there in terms of the distributor not wanting to release it?
Well, I mean, I know the distributors really well, and I know the thinking behind certain horror films in this territory. And, you know, they're not basing it on on some sort of gut instinct. They're basing it on hard data over a long period of time that certain high profile, what am I talking about? Things like paranormal, Blair Witch, that are kind of like phenomena overseas are easy sells, right? Because they are sort of one-off anomalies in terms of, but generic horror stuff, and I'm not saying Cabin in the Woods is generic by any means, but I'm just saying films that don't have $150 million sort of grosses domestic in the US, sometimes really struggle here. Even ones that have got legs, like films that don't open that strongly but continue really healthy runs, like Insidious, they're sort of films that don't even get a chance to live here because they won't let the, they don't grow an audience. They basically die after their first weekend. They're very much front loaded. So it's not just distributors making the call. It's the run that they've had with exhibitors, and then just not hot on horror. And so one of the ideas behind Cabin in the Woods was to show distributors that, hey, smart, intelligent horror films do have an audience here. Let's show them by turning up en masse to these festival screenings and sending a very direct message back to everyone that, hey, they can work for certain films that are good. We're not saying every piece of crap that comes down the pipeline is going to pull an audience in, but this film definitely has the caliber. Plus, it's also got Joss Whedon's fans, who are like one of the most obsessive fan groups out there, the Buffy and the Angel legions of fans, and of course now the Avengers, are very much guys who will turn up and walk the walk in terms of buying tickets.
Do you think that a distributor like Roadshow is built to, I guess, understand or appreciate or make use of a fan base like that? Do you think that a major distributor like that is nimble enough to be able to take advantage?
Well, everything is so scheduled in advance that to have last minute sort of changes in the scheduling really has a domino effect on the way that everything is planned out in terms of their competitive release scheduling. So it's not just what they change, it's how it changes everything else in the marketplace of terms of screen space. So I think there's a lot of thought that goes into these films, like how much is going to be spent to release the film, what's going to come back in, and is it worth it? It's just really a bottom line. Do they get it right every time? I mean, I don't, maybe not, but then it's like no one, it's like William Goldman's classic line, right? Nobody knows anything.
Yeah, exactly. I was just thinking that very same thing.
So there's no formula prediction, even though they've got box office numbers a lot of the time because the films open here after the US. There's anomalies that work down here that don't work in the US. So it's very hard to predict. But horror is just this one particular genre that hasn't had a great record outside of those phenomenons like your Blair Witches and things in this territory.
Yeah. Do you feel that that the industry as a whole is becoming a little bit more gun-shy, a little bit more risk-averse in terms of what it releases and maybe the release patterns?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you just look around what's filling the screens. I mean, it's just all animated kids flicks, giant high tentpole titles. Even though, you know, there's enormous numbers going to certain films, overall, if you really step back and forget about box office numbers, which obviously then everyone operates on cash flow, but there's definitely a decrease in the attendance numbers, no matter what stats you look at. It's tough. It's really tough out there. So, you know, the studios that are just making films that appeal to the widest demographic, they take up all the screens. It's incredibly hard. The idea of the Shangri-La that everyone had of, hey, you've got 12 screens, that means more films are going to be on. It's got, the choice is just going to be incredible. It's like, yeah, but you've got 12 films that are exactly the same.
Mm.
You know, it's very, very tough out there for the independent smaller films. No, I'm not even talking local. I'm just talking very interesting films from overseas. It's lucky we do have art house chains in this country, and for, you know, it would be a completely different playing field if we didn't have those other indies that are out there.
Okay, one more question about this year's festival, and you talked about earlier on about how your own taste sort of guides you through all of the choices that you have. Which is your personal favourite, the one that you think that if people went to see it, they would go, oh, right, that's one of Ant's type of films?
Well, even though I've put money into buying this film, which is a somewhat conflict of interest that I had to clear with the festival early on, but I would stand behind Clown as probably the most bang for buck in the lineup. The Danish comedy is really one of the great crowd experiences that I had last year when I saw it with a packed house. It really, there's nothing as quite infectious as watching a film with a crowd that is absolutely, you know, gut busting laughing. I mean, I have to go back to Something About Mary and seeing that film really early on and just and wanting to take people to it to sit next to them and watch it. I mean, there's really a euphoric high that you get off a film that really delivers massive, massive laughs. And Clown is very much, if you're for people who dig Curb Your Enthusiasm, it's so similar in tone to that, but on a big screen canvas. So even though it's got hangover sort of similarities, it's not an American style film at all. It's very, very Danish in its sensibility, and a lot of the humor is incredibly dry and black, but it delivers possibly the best outro gags of all time of any film that I can't wait to see it with a crowd. So yeah, Clown, the Danish comedy, very, very funny guys. They're going to, if you love the film, then they've made 6 seasons of the same characters. They play themselves in this film. They're guys who are very well known in Denmark, two comedians who play versions of themselves, like hyper-real versions of themselves on the show. And this is the big screen debut, which is a monster, monster smash hit in Denmark. So, yeah, Clown and also Ben Wheatley's Sightseers, who right. I just think Ben Wheatley is one of the great, great up-and-coming directors on the scene. And he, every film he has made, he's made 3 knockout films, and I just can't wait to see where this guy's going. He's just got so much enthusiasm for making films that you see it in every single frame.
Brilliant. Hey, I've got the Wellington program in front of me and I'm looking at Clown and there's only one screening, which is a late night Saturday, well, late-ish night, 10 p.m. on Saturday the 11th of August. Is it getting only one screening in Auckland as well?
No, it's got a couple in Auckland, but it's, you know, it's in the Civic Theatre
right.
on Tuesday, July 31st, 9:30. And it's, yeah, it's got a couple of big ones. So, yeah, I think Wellington, though, is always extremely tight in terms of the amount of films that play in Auckland and versus the amount of screens available in Wellington. So I think everything's very much reduced in terms of the amount of sessions.
Definitely people have to really pick their way carefully through those because there's not many opportunities to see these films.
No, and I mean it's hard, you know. I mean I remember what it was like packing titles for the festival back in before I was working for it, and it's one of those scheduling nightmares that everyone goes through that takes up half your night of highlighter pen and you know, mathematical calculations that sometimes strain your brain. So yeah, it's tough and it's expensive, and so people have to be really choosy these days. So I'd say choose Clown if you're going to choose one. And of course, you know, hopefully some money comes back in so we can maybe pick up further films and get them on the screens down the line. So there's a trickle down effect, obviously, Dan, as well.
Fantastic. That's from the horse's mouth. That's Ant Timpson joining us from Auckland to talk us through the incredibly strange component of the New Zealand International Film Festival this year. Ant, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks, Dan. You know, we could have chatted all day about subjects that no one's interested in except you and myself. So I'm very grateful that you offered me a platform to shill my films to the public. And I am here whenever you need me.